Now you've been compared to Walt Whitman too, and I'm thinking that that comparison is based on probably that your language is accessible. It's simple without being a narrative descriptive that appeals to the working man. Is that fair? Is that something that you did on purpose when you started writing poetry? Was there a conscious effort to appeal to the working man?
No.
No.
No. There never was such an intent on my writing. Never.
Okay.
I want to be understood by smart people. I don't want to insult highly educated, intelligent people by writing Dumbo. I mean,
No, I don't think
I also don't
that
want
was
to
the
write a
intent,
poetry
no.
that is, unavailable. I have made an
Right.
effort to make my poetry available. Yes. But to tell you the truth, I never have in my head an idea of who's going to read it. And now that I'm the age I am, that can cause problems because I'll make references that anybody under the age of 50 won't know what the hell I'm talking about. When you teach, and I didn't quit teaching till 4 or 5 years ago, and I could make a reference to, say, Count Ciano, who was Mussolini's son-in-law and made a famous remark about the Abyssinian War when Mussolini seized Abyssinia, and he described the beauty of these bombs blowing up. He was in a bomber, viewing the murder of Abyssinian natives, and he said how beautiful it was, the way the bombs were like opening of flowers, and it's in a poem by Robert Penn Warren as a reference to it. And I was talking about the poem. They didn't know what the hell I was talking about. Oh, the Italians conquered Abyssinia? Oh, yeah. There was a war there, 1935. Oh, it's like, to them, 1935 was 1015,
Now, you've said that the truth of poetry is not the truth of history. Can you explain that?
Sure. I found that idea when I was an undergraduate in Aristotle. And he says in The Poetics, which is a great essay on the structure, especially on the structure of poetry, that history is what happened, but poetry is what must happen, given the circumstances. At that point, he is writing about dramatic poetry, because theater then was all in poetry. But I think it applies even to fiction and to poetry as well, that you're constructing something that is absolutely necessary, not accidental. And in a way, you are, I mean, because every, we don't, we have a sense that, oh, if I could just gather those details up and put them in a poem, it would be fantastic. Well, it would be junk. Somebody who understands poetry and has an eye for detail and has trained himself can sort out those details to create a sense of what it was like to behold them. And, it's just like a photographer taking a picture. You have to know what the hell you're doing to get into the picture the feelings you had looking at the scene. It's pretty much the same. And everybody who had a camera would take a different picture. He'd move this way, she'd move that way, So our personality comes through because that's what poetry is. It's a vision of the world through the eye and the mind and the senses of a particular person, a man or woman, who has a deep empathy for what he or she is writing about.
Okay. That all sounds very intentional. When you write a poem, do you know where you're going, or does the ending come as a surprise to you?
Well, sometimes it's the beginning that comes as a surprise. Sometimes for me, poetry always comes out of language and or visual imagery. Never comes from an idea. So I almost never know where it's going to go. But sometimes I have actually started poems from like what would turn out to be the end of the poem, and then had to, you know, and then try to accumulate the material and the imagery and create the rhythm and the language that would capture that insight that I had, that moment, satori, whatever, epiphany, that I wanted to capture. I now and then, I think, I remember once I sat down, I needed money, and I sat down and wrote a poem that I knew, I said to myself, I can write a poem the New Yorker will publish, and they paid the best. I was living in Spain at the time, and I wanted to go to Italy. I wanted to go with my wife to Italy. And it was 1965. I didn't have any money. And I sat down, and I wrote this poem directly to the New Yorker. And goddamn, I sold it. They took it. And I had nothing but contempt for that poem. I said, ah. Years later, my wife mentioned it once. How come you never put that poem in a book? So I found it in an old copy of the magazine, and it was good. It was a good poem. The my motives in writing it were completely irrelevant. I mean, I had a good day. I was hot that day. I could write well, and it was a good poem.
You're good even when you don't mean to be, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it is. That's one of the glories of poetry is that you commit yourself to an enterprise that you very dimly understand, because nobody really understands it, but you do it anyway, and you know, if you do it long enough and well enough, you can even make a life out of it, by means of which you meet all kinds of people, interesting people, you go all kinds of places. So, yeah.
Now, you have characters that appear in your poetry, and I think readers tend to think of make-believe characters in prose, in fiction, and that if we write about someone in poetry, it tends to be a real person. I don't know if anybody's ever studied that to be true or not, but I think that's the tendency. Now, you've written about, for instance, sisters, and you don't have any sisters, I believe.
That's right.
How do you develop these characters for your poems? And
they usually have a basis in someone I knew.
Okay.
Usually. Not always. Sometimes I've invented people because I needed them for a poem. But most often I'd say they have a basis. They are, for example, the sisters, all the sisters in my poems are based on a single woman. I mean, she was married, but she was a single woman. She wasn't married when I first knew her. She was a relative. And when I was publishing the poems, that woman was alive. And I didn't want to offend her in any way or you know, I just didn't want her to ever be upset by what she might see of mine in a book. And so I disguised her. I'm not the kind of person who would, you know, I invent brothers. Most of the characters in my poems are invented, but they are based on people I know or knew. Yeah. And I do, you know, I know there are people who really expose their family members to all kinds of nakedness. I'm too Victorian to do that. I just wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Here in Kalamazoo, one of our beloved poets was Herbert Scott, the late Herb Scott, and he was the founder of New Issues Poetry and Prose. I understand he was your student as well. Do you have any memories you could share with Kalamazoo about Herb Scott?
Oh, yeah. Herb was a fantastic student. When I first met him, he was in the class with his then wife, and they both wanted to write fiction, but there was no fiction writing class, so they took that class. I mean, that semester, there was no fiction writing. At the time, I was the only creative writing teacher, and I would teach fiction writing, but that year, that semester, I was teaching poetry. So the two of them enrolled and tried to foist their fiction on me. And I said, no, you're here to write poetry. And I would say by week four or five, Herb was giving me stuff that was incredibly rich. At the time, he worked in a large grocery store, not far from my house, actually. Mm-hmm. And occasionally I would see him there. He was not a kid. He was probably in his 30s. And he had children already. And his poems were full of people, and they were full of the grocery store, the supermarket. I think he was working in vegetables, as I recommend. Yes, as I remember. And the poems were funny, and they really had they were rooted into something strong. And then that was a spring semester. And then a friend of mine came to teach fiction writing. And Herb, for the summer school, and Herb enrolled in the class. And my friend said to me, who was a novelist, "You got a guy in my class. One of your students, he was your poetry student. He's a fantastic fiction writer, too." Oh, I said, yeah, he wanted me to read his fiction, but I made him write poetry. Anyway, Herb was a dream to have in class because he's so smart. And he was also such a generous guy, you know, to the other students, because he was almost always the brightest guy in the class, and he had more experience than the younger kids. He was just a marvelous man and apparently a terrific poker player. That's what my friend, the fiction writer, told me. He said, don't play poker with Herb. He'll take every penny you have. His wife, his widow, lives here in New York City. She's a dean at Hunter College. A marvelous woman.
So what is the ideal poem? And that can be about your personal or anyone's. Is that something that you know in your heart, in your mind, or a combination of both?
I don't think there is a ideal poem. You know, you have the lyric, and I don't know that I would appoint one as the ideal. I mean, I would never think about it in abstract terms.
Okay.
I would just think about, you say, I start thinking about particular lyric poems, The Owl by Edward Thomas, or The Gallows by Edward Thomas, or Transformations by Thomas Hardy. You know, I think of these beautiful, tough, worldly, but song-like poems. And then you have, you know, you have narrative poems, and you have dramatic monologues. So there's so many different kinds of poetry that for me, there is no ideal poem. There are just so many exquisite poems that haunt me, you know, in a good way, not like evil ghosts. Okay, my dear, we are running late, and you want me to read a poem, right?
I would. I would love to hear something of yours.
Oh, what did I do with that book? I had a book. All right. I found a short poem that I like. It's called A Theory of Prosody. So it's about the movement of poetry. A Theory of Prosody. When Nellie, my old pussycat, was still in her prime, she would sit behind me as I wrote. And when the line got too long, she'd reach one sudden black foreleg down and paw at the moving hand, the offensive one. The first time she drew blood, I learned it was poetic to end a line anywhere to keep her quiet. After all, many mornings she'd gotten to the chair long before I was even up. Those nights I couldn't sleep, she'd come and sit in my lap to calm me. So I figured I owed her the short cat line. She's dead now, almost 9 years, and before that there was one during which she faked attention and I faked obedience. Isn't that what it's about? Pretending there's an alert cat who leaves nothing to chance.
Wonderful. Thank you. And thank you for your time. It's been
okay,
very
I'll
enjoyable
see you next
to talk
week,
to you.
My dear.
Oh, I'll be there.